You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Caroline Hanna, Bloomberg's world headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology. And Caroline, momentum in technology stocks halted, a big week of earnings and nervousness also driven by geopolitics.
Certainly is. Let's get straight to it, Ed. Coming up, the US-China tech tension intensifies. The Biden administration weighing cutting off Huawei from US suppliers, while the CEO of TikTok has been called to testify before US lawmakers.
Then Baidu, the so-called Google of China, implementing generative AI into its own search engine.
Plus, our conversation with Brian Johnson. You must have read the story. A 45-year-old entrepreneur who is committed to reverse aging. But first, geopolitics at play. And let's get to that. One of the most read stories on the Bloomberg today, our tech executive editor, Tom Giles, here to break it down when it comes to the world of China versus US. Really, the theme, the tension continues to consternate, really, it feels like. And just talk to us about Huawei, why we're really trying to shut off any supplies from US manufacturers to Huawei.
This is all about isolating Huawei. This is a company that for years, the US presidents, US federal government has singled out Huawei as being a potential source of a threat to our national security. There's concerns about what happens with the equipment that we buy from Huawei. There's concerns about us enabling Huawei to become a bigger and more powerful player with the components that U.S. companies sell to Huawei. This would be yet another step by the Biden administration to isolate Huawei, to cut it off from vital U.S. supplies.
There's a hardening of stance under Biden, even from what it was under President Trump. So President Trump put Huawei on the entity list, but you could get licenses to do business. Which U.S. names are impacted by all of this? Because there are U.S. tech companies doing business with Huawei, or at least looking for exceptions.
That's right. A lot of the business that we do with the U.S. businesses do with Huawei had already been cut off, but there were still some exceptions. For instance, Intel and Qualcomm, two of the companies that would be affected by this move. Those two companies still sell. Intel sells chips for laptops that are made by Huawei, and Qualcomm sells chips that are used in some of the phones that Huawei sells. So you were still having some U.S. companies do business with Huawei. Mm. This is an example of the Biden administration being under tremendous pressure from Republicans in Congress to stay tough on China and not show signs of letting up, not show anything that the Republicans consider to be a sign of weakness.
And notably, Tom, of course, this is going international in terms of the administration looking to the Netherlands, to Japan. That was last week's story, wasn't it? Trying to get other countries to put similar tough stances on China.
You can't do this alone. Even though the U.S. is a major leader in chip-making capabilities, technologies, you can't do it alone because NXP, for example, from the Netherlands, sells some chip-making equipment into China that is highly specialized, highly very technical, and very lucrative for NXP. And it's a technology that you just cannot replicate easily. China certainly can't do it. So the U.S. cannot fully isolate China. And remember, the U.S. wants to make make it hard for China to become a powerhouse in chip-making capabilities. This is something that the Chinese have been behind the U.S. for time immemorial. They have made it a commitment. They have made a commitment to spending the money that it takes to become a leader in chip-making technology, and the U.S. is saying no way to that.
Bloomberg's executive editor for technology, Tom Giles, across that big breaking headline this afternoon. Now, let's dive into the world of TikTok, because the CEO, Shou Chew, Caroline, is going to testify before the House Energy and Commerce Committee on the company's privacy policies, the impact on children, and the company's relationship with the Communist Party. I want to bring in Alex Barinka on this. Alex, what to expect?
You can expect potentially a bit of a spicy hearing here. This is the very first time that TikTok CEO Shou Chew will actually be testifying before a committee that's been known in the past for grilling Mark Zuckerberg on the Cambridge Analytica scandal and for really digging in on details around child privacy and around data sharing. And as we've talked about before, the Republicans in Congress are really concerned about the company's connection to China through its Chinese parent company. So you can expect questions on all of those things. We also often see in these House committee hearings the representatives pushing the executives to make promises, to agree to do things. You can see some questions potentially around cutting off data or around putting up some blockades with their Chinese parent company.
Alex, just remind us where we are. Because the administration, in many ways, is meant to be leading this. CFIUS is meant to be leading this. This is meant to be, in many ways, a deal with Oracle we're all discussing. Where are we in that timeline?
Similar to the Huawei situation, this is another situation where congressional Republicans are putting a lot of pressure on the Biden administration, who in the background for years has been going through a national security review, looking at TikTok, looking at connections with its Chinese parent company that our sources tell us is getting there. But there were some hiccups with particularly some members of the Department of Justice who are on the committee who were not comfortable with some of the concessions that the company was bringing to the table in the negotiations. So it seems like a lot of Republicans in both the Senate and the House are saying, look, we need to wrap this up or we're going to take this into our own hands. We're going to introduce bills, which they have done, the first of which will come to a vote to the House Committee on Foreign Affairs next month, just before this hearing with the CEO going down to D.C.
Alex, what surprised me in our reporting around this is that it's the first time that TikTok CEO Chu appears formally in a hearing. We've heard from other executives. He was on stage, of course, earlier in the year with one of our senior leadership or senior editors here at Bloomberg. What do we know about his ability to field these kinds of questions and basically engage with U.S. lawmakers?
Well, he has basically been operating behind the scenes thus far. My colleague in D.C. and I wrote a big story last fall looking at their lobbying efforts, which were kind of behind closed doors. He was down there. He was taking meetings. Now, I'll tell you, Ed, the company has taken kind of a change in stance. We've seen them get pretty loud and much more forward about what they're doing, describing some of the data security policies that they're looking to put in place. And this will really be the first time that he's out front. We've seen Vanessa Pappas, who is the chief operating officer. She has been kind of the de facto face for TikTok here in the U.S. She did testify at Congress, made a bunch of promises about data security controls, basically tried to put forth a message of you need to trust us that we're not sharing any information with the Chinese government. Now, there have been some kind of critical reports over the last month, including the company admitting that some employees of its parent company, ByteDance, access the data of U.S. users, including a number of journalists. So that trust has obviously been degraded, which, again, is probably the reason we're seeing some heightened heat coming out of D.C. against this company.
Bloomberg's Alex Barinka, terrific reporting around what is a focus for everyone right now, TikTok, and whether it's going to have a future here in the United States. Now, back to me in San Francisco, where Twitter made its first interest payment on the $12.5 billion of debt that Elon Musk used to take the company private last year. Twitter paid a group of seven banks led by Morgan Stanley roughly $300 million, according to sources and Bloomberg calculations. Questions over how the company will pay off its debt remain since the Musk takeover. Twitter's failed to pay millions of dollars in rent, been sued by contractors over unpaid services, and of course auctioned off items not necessarily to raise money.
Before the release of ChatGPT, many people had been underestimating the progress that AI has been making over the last few years.
I actually think the UK is one of the most interesting places in the world for artificial intelligence today.
We have to get governments to think about how best to regulate this new, very fast emerging industry.
A lot of other large companies that are figuring out what are they going to do. Google is the most notable one on the sideline. I think they have bigger regulatory headwinds.
People want regulation for AI. They want to feel safe.
Microsoft's ambitions are going to continue to expand far outside of just enterprise software.
So there's going to be a lot of progress over the next couple of years. I think it'll be pretty fun to watch.
And we are going to keep on talking about it, Ed, the rise of generative AI. And we know actually quite a lot about the US-based work on that front, but this is an international project.
Right. Yeah, really fascinating reporting from Bloomberg out of China. And according to a Bloomberg source, Baidu is working on something very similar to ChatGPT. It was interesting because at one point in Monday's session, the US-listed shares or ADRs of Baidu were up almost 2.5%. All told, we closed down 0.4%, but there was some kind of momentum behind the stock based on this reporting. We don't know a lot. What we do know is that it could come as soon as March. And what would Baidu would do, and remember, Baidu is the so-called Google of China, but they're planning to embed this artificial intelligence platform into their existing services. And, you know, what we know from a design perspective, in terms of a capability perspective, is that Baidu's chat tool or chat AI would basically give you a conversational response, just like ChatGPT has done. But this is really interesting. You and I have been talking a lot in recent weeks about China's move into artificial intelligence, the hype around artificial intelligence here in North America and beyond. And luckily, we have just the right person to discuss the hype in AI, Dr. Alex Hanna, Director of Research at the Distributed AI Research Institute. Where should we start? Let's start with that news and China.
Right. It's not surprising that Baidu would go ahead and try to work on a ChatGPT type product. This thing has taken English language sources by storm. It would make sense. And Baidu being China's Google, they have the amount of data that it takes to actually train one of these very large models. This is a kind of AI model known as a transformer. So Baidu would naturally go into that space and make something.
When we talk about the hype, I mean, you are an academic, a researcher in this field. When you see a name like Baidu moving into this space, do you think that they are a credible player? Do you think, okay, I'm interested in what they're working on here?
They're definitely a credible player. I mean, they have mass stores of data. They are already in so many different spaces. Google's in that space, Microsoft, Facebook, and whatnot. And so it makes sense that they're going to take these kinds of technologies and move into the space where they're building these models that can generate language at such a large scale and take a massive amount of queries.
I mean, much has been written over the years about the race in AI between US and China, and for many, they were thought that China was ahead, particularly when you think of all the language basis, the way in which they have connected devices in the home. I'm interested, Dr. Hanna, in what about the ethics race here? I have a feeling that many would say the US is thinking about that, but are they thinking about it quickly enough? Are they thinking about some of the biases that are baked in within artificial intelligence? Are they trying to think and get ahead of that as it starts to take us by storm?
I think they're trying to find out what's happening, but as we've seen with ChatGPT, when you feed it some kinds of inputs, especially around race and gender, it produces these biased outputs, and this has been shown time and time again. Since we don't have a lot of visibility into what Baidu's doing, we're not sure what's going to happen there. We've seen their uses of AI be biased against certain ethnic groups, like the Uyghurs, so it's not quite, we don't know necessarily what kind of biases are going to happen there and how it's going to exacerbate further inequality there.
Is it exacerbating racial, gender, class inequality at the moment in the US already, or are people managing to tamp down or at least start to learn, ensure that that's the models aren't building that in?
I think there's a potential for it, definitely. In English language, there's less of that possibility just because there's been, these issues have been documented by many people before. But as these things are being used in other domains where we don't have a good idea of what kinds of biases may be baked in, especially when it starts getting away from English language, there's not enough data that really is there and not enough regulators or legislators focusing on that to prevent that from happening.
Let's talk hype.
There Let's was, talk
about it. Well, you know, I think that Caroline and I have gone over with you in the show in recent weeks, worries about plagiarism or how artificial intelligence might contribute to inequality across race, gender. But everyone's talking about artificial intelligence nonetheless. There's an interest to use it. Does that worry you or excite you?
It does both. It worries me because I think the way that we think about artificial intelligence, we think about artificial intelligence as this kind of separate consciousness that is going to emerge as this thing of science fiction. We talk to ChatGPT like it is an actual person, but really what it is something that is taking existing data and reproducing in patterns that it's seen before. But it has a lot of ways in which it could be generative, it could be helpful, it could help human flourishing, especially when we're thinking about ways in which language technologies could be useful, especially in places that don't have a lot of good translation, that collaboration could be really fruitful with affected communities. But right now, as it is, especially as it's being controlled by players like OpenAI, Microsoft, and Baidu, it's probably going to reproduce a lot of those inequalities that we've seen before.
Dr. Hanna, what's interesting is that, of course, your DARE itself, Distributed AI Research Institute, it sort of comes at it from a community-based focus. You're trying to move away from what is called on your website, big tech's pervasive influence. What about the startup, the seed scene, the smaller players within AI that are building something really exciting? We talk a lot about OpenAI and Microsoft, and we know the power that Alphabet has within the realm of AI. Who else is doing this on a smaller scale but with really interesting outcomes?
We've seen this less, I'd say, on the seed scene, at least for what we see the major players feeding, especially in venture capital in the U.S., but we've definitely seen projects like Masakani, which is a collective of African researchers using AI for machine translation on the continent. Also, Lasan AI, who's one of their fellows, Ashmalash Teka, works with us in doing machine translation and automatic speech recognition for some languages that are less represented. And so the more and more we see AI being done with community players as a means of sourcing groups that have been less resourced, I think those have been some really exciting uses and deployments of AI. I think there's a push to rush towards doing things that big tech is doing. We've actually seen a mass exodus from places like Google, where people have gone ahead and start to try to develop these large language models, but it tends to be in English and it tends to be in a way that's going to attract the most eyes from VCs in ways that they're going to get the most investment. So these community-based projects, I think, are really interesting.
Just quickly, mass exodus, can you quantify that?
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I did see a story about something like 30 researchers that were coming from Google Brain, which is an organization that I came from, had left the company since, I want to say, in the past 2 years, mostly to found things that were focused on AI, language technologies, and they're afforded that kind of nimbleness and going into the startup space. They can get that seed funding, they can kind of produce a product that might be quicker to market than a place like Google that is a little slower to react in those cases.
Dr. Alex Hanna, thank you for your time. Director of Research at the Distributed AI Research Institute. Great to have you in the studio. Meanwhile, coming up, the EV price wars are building up. Ford now slashing some of its own prices following Tesla. More on that. It's Ed's Sweet Spot. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists, But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Is this the start of an EV price war? Ford is now cutting prices in the US on the electric Mustang Mach-E. The move is meant to counter Tesla's price cuts earlier this month, which were as deep as 20%. And according to Elon Musk, that did spur new demand for Tesla. Now, across all of Ford's Mach-E versions, it's an average trim of $4,500. But the more significant cuts are on the most expensive versions. The GT Extended Range, for example, drops $5,900 to start at $63,995. The move brings the Mach-E in line with new caps on EV prices, which qualify for a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 under the Inflation Reduction Act. Ford's also offering discounted financing rates as low as 5.3%. Now, last year, Ford was the number two EV seller in the US, but that was way behind Tesla, which controls almost two-thirds of the market.
As always, you're first and foremost with all this sort of news, Ed. And just talk to us about why Ford is doing this. Of course, many would say it's because of the Tesla response. Some would say it's actually to try and make it more available to certain subsidies, right?
Yeah, I think a number of analysts are saying this is just a response to Tesla. But my point in that piece is, well, they're cutting prices where the vehicle's already most expensive, which would give evidence that they're trying to make them eligible for this $7,500 tax credit and take advantage of that. So it's an interesting one. But Ford kind of talks a big game, right, about how demand is outweighing their ability to supply right now because they didn't build that many of them last year.
And so to that point, I mean, what's interesting in the story, it shows that this was sort of already a loss-making type of car anyway.
Right.
So ultimately, are they just deciding to take a hit to margin where necessary on certain types? What about the rest of the EV vehicles that they want to be coming out with?
Yeah, so Ford had planned for the Mach-E to be profitable from unit one. That just didn't happen. It's unprofitable because of rising input costs, commodities. But their plan now, ramp up volume production, make more of them and improve margins to offset these price cuts.
Heard that before. What is it? It seems to be volumes over margins at the moment over at Tesla.
It's the way to go.
Did you get a video game for Christmas? If so, whoever gifted you that got off cheap. Prices for games, toys, and hobbies fell 4.8% in the year to December. That's mostly due to cheaper computer games, according to the UK Office for National Statistics. So what happened in December? Three things. First, a lack of releases in 2022. New games tend to be more expensive, so since there weren't that many hot pricey launches, people simply had more discounted titles to choose from. To be fair, there were a few new games in December, but none of them made it to the top of the charts. For example, the latest Need for Speed was the best performing in 14th place, but sales for the first 5 weeks were 40% lower than its 2019 version. Second, holiday discounts. Gaming companies ran their typical Black Friday and Christmas deals to push sales for existing games. Look at FIFA 23, the top game in December in the UK, which was discounted as much as 70%. And third, despite cheaper prices, fewer people were buying games. It looks like quality, not price, is king, even in a cost of living crisis. So does that mean video games are getting cheaper? Well, the short answer is probably not. 2022 was a corrective year after two exceptional years of lockdown-fueled growth for the entire gaming industry. So prices will probably rise again. That's, of course, if all launches go as planned.
That was Quick Take's Irina Angel. So let's stick with gaming news, Caroline. Meta reported to have cut contracts with at least 200 gaming creators. According to the information, Meta ended the relationships in the second half of 2022 and also cut contracts with streamers who weren't successful building an audience, the information said, citing a Meta spokesperson. It's also a big week for the giants of the industry, with Electronic Arts, EA, reporting earnings Tuesday, and we get a readout on PlayStation demand when Japan's Sony reports numbers on Wednesday. So let's get into it with Josh Chapman, co-founder and managing partner at Convoy, an early stage gaming investment firm. You recently launched a $150 million new fund, which will take in assets under management to around $270 million. And you're out with a new report on the state of the gaming industry. See how much is going on right now, Josh, in the world of gaming. I think what's interesting for me is that the conclusion of your report is that there is a pathway to growth here. Talk us through what you found.
Absolutely. And thank you again for having me on the show. So what we noticed in 2022 is essentially three things. One is that gaming investment is up about 2x where it was in 2020 and pre-pandemic levels. So gaming investment is increasing while the industry, as your great segment just showed, continues to increase. The second thing we noticed is that there's about $45 billion in cash sitting on the corporate balance sheets of gaming companies today, creating an incredibly healthy gaming M&A environment. The third thing that we're noticing is, given, as you all well know, that the IPO markets are closed, late stage investing in the gaming market has slowed almost to a grinding halt, while early stage continues to grow. As you see in this chart, gaming will continue to grow and is expected to continue to grow over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
We had a report last year that showed that gaming over the last two recessions was incredibly resilient. So no matter where we're at right now, we think that we'll continue to thrive as an industry.
Josh, I'm interested to go back to the consolidation point. There's a lot of cash on balance sheets, but there's also a lot of regulation about where that cash is put to work. We just think about Microsoft and Activision. Is that deal going to go through? Does that matter? Do we see more waves of this?
Absolutely. So the FTC is absolutely doing their job in trying to protect the gaming market. Our opinion is that their objections to this M&A acquisition is actually unfounded. One, it's based on what might happen and not what is happening. And that's a really key thing to highlight here. We think this acquisition should go through. We think it will go through. We believe that this is absolutely a fair acquisition. You know, it's worth highlighting that post-acquisition, the gaming revenue to Microsoft would be around $21 billion. That would be about 11% of the entire gaming market. But right now, Sony makes about $18 billion in the market. And there's actually a lot of competitors that are in that similar range. So we think the FTC is worried about what might happen. And we think that sets a very dangerous precedent for M&A across not only gaming, but broader entertainment and IP in general. So we think this should go through. We think it will go through after it gets through all the objections, but certainly an intense environment.
Broader entertainment is an interesting one, because we know that Netflix has been making eyes at the view of getting into gaming more, and we've seen it as evidence. Are these the sort of companies that start picking off interesting companies, and what kinds of companies do you see this consolidation occurring in?
Absolutely. Great question. So Netflix is actively building out a games business. Basically, this is in reaction to the fact that passive entertainment is losing out to interactive entertainment. Passive entertainment, which is one way, like Hulu or HBO Go or Netflix, is losing out to two-way interactive entertainment, which gaming has been a professional at for 50 years. So this interactive entertainment is where a lot of groups like Netflix and Amazon and Google are moving towards. You're even going to see Disney eventually enter the space in a much bigger way. I think that a lot of the cash on the balance sheet of broader tech companies is not only going to compete, but likely enter in new ways into the gaming industry alongside the active $45 billion in cash that gaming companies like the traditional ones like Activision Blizzard and Nintendo have.
It's interesting because you cite those numbers in your report, right? You look at the cash some of the mega cap tech companies have, and the conclusion you draw is there's still a healthy M&A environment. And yet, Caroline and I are here waiting every day for some updates around Activision, Microsoft. Will it happen? Won't it happen? What will the regulators do? Do you think it will happen?
I do. I do. In the short, Ed, I do. And the reason why is because the objections are based on the theoretical of what might happen in the future. I don't think that's going to win out in court. I think it sets a dangerous precedent for future M&A across all of entertainment, not just gaming, of, well, we might become a monopoly, so therefore we should stop this M&A. The FTC later could retroactively, if their fears become realized, can step back in and try to slap the hand of Microsoft and say, hey, you need to divest or you need to separate. So they could always step in later if their fears are realized, but right now it's a really tricky environment and it would set a weird precedent across all of the FTC's scrutiny of different markets.
Okay, Josh, your funds, your new ones, where is then ripe to invest?
There's essentially going to be a few areas that a lot of hype is going to be generated around AI, so around gaming. One of those is artificial intelligence. People are talking about artificial intelligence is going to make the creation process much easier. We think that is absolutely going to play out, but it will be very tricky how this is going to exactly going to play out from a tech standpoint and whether it will be investable to build billion-dollar companies. So question mark, but that will be invested in. The second is Web3. People are waiting for Web3 and blockchain technology to really provide a monetization addition to the gaming industry in the same way that we saw free-to-play back in the emergence of mobile. The third is probably going to be around, you know, new marketplace dynamics in the virtual reality space. So as virtual reality continues to be adopted, we think there'll be continued investment. Some of the areas that we're most excited about as a firm is things around the intersection of gaming and education, gaming and healthcare, and gaming and VR. That's really kind of where we're seeing a lot of exciting opportunities.
All right, Josh Chapman, Convoy co-founder and managing partner. Caroline knows that I've been wanting to have this conversation for weeks, months, purely about video gaming. Let's talk again in a few months' time and see how it goes. Now, from video gaming to my other passion, streaming. Paramount has announced that Showtime will merge with its Paramount Plus service. The merge will be across both linear and streaming platforms, resulting in a rebranding of the pay TV channel to Paramount Plus with Showtime. Bit of a mouthful. The updated offerings and Showtime name change will launch later in 2023 and only affect the premium tier of Paramount Plus and the Showtime linear network in the US, Caro.
Meanwhile, Ed, we've got to talk a little bit about, well, maybe both of our passions, crypto, Bitcoin, and the entire digital asset class. They're having their best start to the year in a decade. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes. 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
SoFi jumped Monday after announcing plans to reach profitability in 2023. Shares surged after the company posted record revenue across all three business segments, lending, technology platform, and financial services. Bloomberg's Shanali Basak discussed all of those results with SoFi CEO Anthony Noto earlier.
It's really a reflection of our strategy coming to fruition. We're building a digital platform where members can come and do all their financial business with us. We're helping our members borrow better, save better, spend better, protect and invest better. And that one-stop shop approach has allowed us to develop a diversified business where in certain markets, some businesses can do well offsetting others. And that's what you see today. Really strong growth in our checking savings accounts business, which is helping drive our deposits. And we're using those deposits to fund loans that we're getting good returns on and good credit performance. And then we're also continuing to see great growth in our invest business as well as credit card business. So it's all coming to fruition in this market.
You told me a little earlier today that you're looking to be the biggest in the country when it comes to checking and savings. Who are you really competing with? And is there anywhere in particular you're gaining share? Name names here. Who are you competing with?
Sure. We have aspirations to be the biggest in each of our business. Checking savings account is one where we're currently winning share from the large, most well-known banks in the United States. The growth that we're seeing there is not just strong in absolute number, but also high in quality. 85% of our deposits are from direct deposit customers. We're attracting them because we're giving them an unprecedented value proposition. We're giving 2.5% interest on checking, which is significantly higher than others. We also have complete functionality on your phone. You can pay with your phone. You can do person-to-person payments. You can use debit transactions. And we give you rewards for activities within checking and savings, no fees, free overdraft, and free roundups. And you're a member at SoFi and get all the rest of our benefits. On savings, we'll be offering 3% later this week, up from 2.5%. So it's a really unmatched value proposition, and that's helping us win share and drive really high-quality members with great stickiness because of the direct deposit.
Anthony, 3% is significant based on what you're seeing out there in the market. Do you think it's problematic? I know you gain share as other rates are lower, but do you think it's problematic that the banks are not really passing on those rates to their clients?
We have a structural advantage. We have both a lower cost of capital now, lower cost of funding because we have the bank license, but we also lend those deposits. And so when we have deposits coming in at 2.5% or 3.5%, we're lending them out at a much higher percentage, and that's driving economic value for us. If another bank is driving deposits, but they're not lending, and many of them do not lend, then they're not getting a return on those deposit gains, and they'll have lower return on equity. And so we have a great combination of businesses where those deposits can be used to drive high ROE, and that's what we're looking to maximize.
That was SoFi CEO Anthony Noto. And meanwhile, Carrie, things are actually looking up for crypto's largest asset.
Yeah, remember, SoFi's been trying to get in on the crypto wave a little bit as well. And maybe the wave's coming back. Bitcoin, just check out the OG of the crypto space. Best January since 2013. In fact, up 39% in 30 days. Look, it's more base. The rally in virtual coins. Look, they've managed to pump through some of the fallout and the collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX. We know that, of course, they managed to shake off the latest news from Genesis. You can see, look, these smaller coins too. Solana up 138%, let's call it. Axie Infinity to do with the gaming up 77%. Decentraland, look, it's still at 0.735, but that's up almost 150%. So $280 billion is about how much digital assets have climbed over the course of January.
Yeah, and there's an element of inevitability, but it's not just the digital assets themselves. Blockchain or crypto-related stocks also on the mend since the FTX fiasco. I mean, when you talk about correlation, there's no sort of higher degree of correlation between cryptocurrencies and the stocks whose companies only do crypto-related underlying technology or the assets themselves.
Well said, though. Correlation, these are risk assets, and indeed the risk universe has been going higher. We've seen the Nasdaq outperform too, but it's notable they really have managed to come back. Look, it's no secret that people are willing to spend big on their health. LeBron James spends upward of $1.5 million per year on his body. Tom Brady invests in what he sees as age-defying supplements, but their health routines look like child's play compared to one Brian Johnson, the tech entrepreneur behind Braintree Payment Solutions. He's got 30 doctors and health experts monitoring his every bodily function while following an extremely stringent daily routine, which he calls the blueprint. 45 years old Johnson says he's slowed his pace of aging by 24% and managed to reduce his biological age by 5 years already. He's on track to spend, though, $2 million on his efforts this year. Joining us to discuss the Blueprint CEO, the founder, Brian Johnson. Wow, I mean, tell us, what effects have you seen so far?
It was pretty remarkable. We didn't really know what to expect when we started. The 5.1-year age reversal for epigenetics was interesting. And then slowing the speed of aging by 25% was something that we found really exciting. It's probably exceeded our expectations.
When we say stringent, 1,977 vegan calories a day, 2 dozen supplements and medicines, exercise an hour a day plus high intensity 3 times a week, sleep at the same time every night after 2 hours of wearing glasses and block blue light. I don't think I particularly want 33,000 images of my bowels, but you were doing this for another reason, a purpose. Where does this go in terms of next stage therapies?
The idea behind the project was if you could measure all 70 plus organs of your body and enable each organ to speak, your heart and lungs and liver and pancreas, and express what they need to be in an ideal state, and then take those needs, look at gold standard scientific evidence, and then create a protocol. And I've agreed to go through that process. And so we make hundreds of measurements of my body every few months, and we just reference the scientific literature, and we do this again and again, and we try to fine tune it. And so we're trying to basically create the perfect diet and health protocol. And so I've spent millions of dollars developing this with a world-class group of scientists and doctors, and I've made it all available for others at no cost, that people can implement it, improve upon it, they can record their own data. It's really meant to push the entire field forward.
Well, Brian, that's the point I'm fascinated by, the reaction. We've been showing your morning routine on the screen, your exercise, your calorie target. To be fair, it's not that much different than mine, and yet I'm definitely aging quickly. But do you sympathize with the reaction to this story that actually for most everyday people, this is not a reality? This is not an accessible method of reversing the effects of aging.
I absolutely do. And I mean, it really started when I was in a pretty bad situation. I was, I'd had chronic depression for a decade. I tried everything to fix it and I was feeling hopeless. And there was one particular version of myself and I playfully referred to him as Evening Brian. 7 p.m. Brian would roll around and the day's stress would be very heavy and he would inevitably eat too much food or the wrong food. And then that would cause poor sleep and it would cause the next morning feeling groggy and I'd be overweight. And so one day playfully I said, Evening Brian is fired from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. or 10 p.m. This version of myself has no authority to decide if he's going to eat. And it was the first time I really understood me as different versions of myself. And so while I do understand that the protocol I have now is pretty daunting for most people, the basic principle I think is true for everybody. We all have these versions inside of us where we commit this self-destructive behavior and we do so again and again. And oftentimes some of the biggest gains can be made if we just stop some of those more self-destructive behaviors.
Brian, we asked our audience what they were willing to do to achieve longevity, I suppose, if you're not thinking about aging in reverse. And this is what they had to say. Pretty split, you know, a third of respondents, all my money. And don't you laugh? And then, you know, 36%, nothing, YOLO. I think Ashley, again, touches on this in the story about how doctors praised you for what you've done, but actually for the everyday person, it's not achievable. What of all the things that you did are the simplest that you felt this is an easy change that has really helped me?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the expectation of Blueprint is not that the individual person is going to be able to do all these things. The objective is to show that if this protocol is implemented, you can achieve remarkable results in slowing the rate of aging and reversing aging. And then if that's the case, it really is a contemplation I find interesting is, could we do this as a society, make this standard where we don't ask people to go out and navigate McDonald's and algorithms that are trying to addict them and everywhere they turn. And so this is really about trying to create change, a change in society. But for the basic simple things people can do, prioritize sleep, eat more vegetables, nuts and berries, and stop self-destructive behaviors. And you're off to a pretty good start.
Brian Johnson, Blueprint CEO and founder. Come back, tell us how it's all still going. That does it from this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Ed.
Yeah, Tuesday, Nikola CEO. You don't want to miss it. A big sit down for us. This is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.